7 days since they'd ridden out of Dostum's camp in the mountains. Not that much time, really. But for most of it, they had expected to die at any minute. Now they were together again. "This feels good," thought Diller, flopping down on a cool strip of grass in the fort shadow. Soon he was fast asleep. As Nelson and his team settled into the fort, Dean sat down to a feast in Atta's safe house. The men passed around platters of goat, rice, and fruit, washing the mouthfuls down with lots of instant coffee. The house was bordered by gardens and a pond, an oasis within scarred metal security walls. A chubby, dark-haired young man with doleful eyes introduced himself to Dean as the son of the owner. He spoke perfect English and said his name was Najib. Najib Qureshi. Dean's interest in meeting an English speaker and possible interpreter was dampened when Najib started asking questions. "Do you have a family? Where do you live in the United States? What kind of military training did you go through?" Dean wondered, incorrectly, if Najib was some kind of spy for the Taliban. If this hadn't been Najib's home, he would have kicked him out to the street. Dean resolved that they had to move to a new safe house as soon as possible. There was, in fact, much more to worry about. Local citizens were walking up to the gate outside with news that suicide bombers had targeted Dean and his team. "How did they find us so quickly?" he wondered. Dean instructed Brian Lyle to send news of the threat up to K2. They set up a security perimeter around the house and went over an escape route in case of attack. This was called their go-to-hell plan. Operation Sergeant Brad Hyland placed a large orange panel on the roof. Now if they had to be extracted by helicopter, the pilot could easily find them. They also made up a go-to-hell signal, a word that any one of them could utter, if they had to leave the house immediately. This word would mean only one thing: get out now. The word they chose was Titans, after the Tennessee Titans NFL team. As Dean listened to gunfire erupt across the city, he received more bad news. Several of Atta's men had just been gunned down as they walked up to the Sultan Reza's girls' school. Dean told the team to check the situation at the school and radio their report. He would remain at the safe house and direct operations from there. The Taliban were firing from the windows when Stu Mansfield and Brian Lyle rolled up in a truck a few minutes later. Mansfield backed the vehicle behind a corner out of the line of fire. By standing in the bed of the pickup, he could see the entrance to the school, enough of a vantage to get a sense of the situation. The school building was a drab glass and metal complex. Now its rooms were filled with refuse, firewood, weapons, and feces. Atta had been convinced he could get the enemy fighters inside the school to surrender. They were militant Al-Qaeda soldiers, Pakistanis mostly, who'd been abandoned by the Taliban during their retreat. Atta's thinking was guided by the school's proximity to the Blue Mosque, several blocks away, and to the hundreds of mud and cinder block houses in the surrounding neighborhoods. He couldn't attack the school without casualties or collateral damage. It was a sticky situation, requiring a light touch, the warlord's genius. Back at the safe house, in a meeting with Atta, before the team had left, Dean had suggested laser-guided bombs could be dropped on the school. Dangerous, but possible. Atta had disagreed. He explained that 9 more of his soldiers were already in the building, trying to negotiate a surrender. This news surprised Dean. "Well, sir, what do you want to do?" he had asked. "I want to wait." They decided they would give diplomacy a second chance, and if it failed, Dean would level the building. Mansfield now looked at Atta's 2 envoys, lying dead on the grass outside the school's front doors, and wondered if diplomacy really was an option here. The envoys had walked up to the doors, carrying the Quran opened before them, the pages facing outward at the fighters inside, a sign of peace. The bullets that killed them had passed through the books and riddled their bodies. When he heard news of the siege at the school, Dostum, in his office at Kala Ijangi, had decided he wanted to bomb the building immediately. Around him, his workmen were already hammering, sweeping, and painting, repairing the damage caused during the Taliban occupation. Electrical wire hung from the ceiling, ripped out by the fleeing fighters. But then Atta had called and informed Dostum that the school had been surrounded by his men, and that the people of Mazar would object to a bomb being dropped in their neighborhood. It would risk lives and jeopardize Atta and Dostum's support among Mazar's citizens. Dostum grunted, reluctantly agreeing. About this time, Mitch Nelson was standing in the courtyard of the fortress with Lieutenant Colonel Bowers. Neither had been privy to the discussion between Dostum and Atta, nor to Atta's insistence that he was in control of the situation. Dostum told the Americans that a cleric had been killed in a gunfight at the school, and that the enemy fighters inside had refused to surrender. Dostum explained that he wanted to bomb the place and quickly end the siege. Nelson and Bowers questioned Dostum about the wisdom of such an attack. Dostum reminded them that he had seen how accurate Nelson and his men could be with bombs. Bowers, nonetheless, felt Dostum wanted to act too quickly, and both he and Nelson worried that hundreds of civilians could die. However, after talking over the situation, they decided to send a team into the school. Sonny Tatum, Fred Falls, Patrick Remington, and Charles Jones pulled up a block from the building. With them was CIA officer Mike Spann. While the others stayed at the truck, Tatum and Spann moved forward several hundred yards, dashing from corner to corner, looking for a building from which to watch the school. To blend in, Tatum had changed into jeans and a dark buttoned shirt. Tatum picked a nearby building, and he and Spann climbed the back stairs. At the top, Tatum unpacked his laser gear and radios, and set up an approach for two F-18 jets on station overhead. Using the rangefinder, he measured the distance between himself and the school at 300 yards. Close. Too close. He and Spann would be in danger of being blown up. He also didn't have a clear line of sight. Too many of the buildings in the neighborhood were the same height. But to get a straight shot with the laser, he'd have to get even closer. He was screwed. Tatum aimed the green, box-shaped soft-lam at the schoolhouse and pressed the trigger. The device chirped as it shot out the laser, but he couldn't get a good bead on the building. Only one corner and part of the roof's southern edge. He needed to place the laser in the middle of the roof in order to ensure an accurate drop on the target. This left a final option, most dangerous of all. Tatum turned to Spann and said, "We need to get to the schoolhouse. They would need the GPS coordinates of the building's position." Tatum had a plan. They made their way back down the stairs and dashed from building to building, right up to the school. They stood against it, backs pressed to the east wall, near the corner. Tatum pushed the button on the face of his GPS, logging in the latitude and longitude coordinates of his position. They next dashed down the wall to the west corner, and Tatum pushed the button again. They ran to another corner and repeated the process. You couldn't get more perfect coordinates, except by climbing atop the roof. Tatum thought that at any minute they'd be spotted by one of the Al-Qaeda soldiers inside. Overhead, on the second floor, most of the windows had been busted out. Tatum could hear voices, angry voices. Pushing off the wall, they sprinted a short distance to a nearby building and caught their breath. No gunfire followed them. Quickly, they ran back up the stairs to the Overwatch building and set up the strike. Over his radio, Tatum asked the two pilots, "See that raggedy-ass house with the boarded windows? Now look to your left." And here Tatum was careful to visualize himself inside each pilot's cockpit, orienting himself from above as the pilot was oriented. From the air, the school was T-shaped. The lead pilot said he could see the T-shape. Now they had a visual ID. Tatum then relayed the GPS coordinates as well. Tatum and Span crouched down on the roof and waited. Inside the school, the men who had entered as Atta's envoys, after the first group had been attacked, were in the middle of negotiations with a group of enemy soldiers. They had managed to escape being gunned down, so far. At the same time, Remington, Jones, and Falls were positioned around the block inside of the school, but out of sight of Mansfield and Lyle. Each team had no idea that the other was there. Standing in his pickup, Brian Lyle was trying to reach Nelson's team at Kalai Jangi, but for some reason his radio malfunctioned. He couldn't get through. He wanted to let Nelson know that he and Mansfield were at the school. Lyle had no idea that Nelson was already aware of the siege. Back at Atta's safe house, Dean was also trying to connect with Dostum and Nelson. It was dawning on Dean that the teams had entered the city so quickly and at such different paces that they hadn't updated each other with their locations. Dean wasn't even sure if Dostum had arrived in Mazar yet. The situation was fluid. Too fluid, Dean thought. Curious about the unfolding events, he and Brad Hyland were ready to drive over to the school when they heard the explosion. They looked up. Dean was shocked to see how close the mushroom cloud was. Just 3 or 4 blocks away. Who dropped that fucking bomb? Dean wanted to know. And then, Atta's men just got smoked. How was he going to explain to Atta that the United States of America had just killed his men? Up on the rooftop overlooking the school, Tatum checked back with the pilots. Olive 31, this is Tomcat. Request a second drop. The bomb, guided by the GPS inside it, had hit the center of the school's roof, just as Tatum had planned. The back wall and east side of the building had collapsed. A handful of enemy soldiers had stumbled from the building and disappeared down the street. The second jet pilot announced he was ready to drop. Tatum ducked, just as the projectile streaked in. The earth moved beneath him, beneath the building. Thunder rolled down the city streets. 2 blocks away, the explosion rocked Stu Mansfield and Brian Lyle. Mansfield, the radio still in his hand, was furious and confused. The Afghans with them, Atta's men, glared at Mansfield and Lyle, equally uncertain of what had just happened. Mansfield didn't know how many of Atta's men were in the building, but he knew they were dead. And that wasn't good news. He held up the radio. "I didn't do it," he told Atta's soldiers. "I didn't call in those bombs." They didn't seem to be buying the protest. Mansfield and Lyle agreed they should leave the area immediately. Mansfield felt terrible over what just happened. Dean could have been in that building. What then? They started the truck and sped away, back to the safe house. From his position, Tatum surveyed the damage of the second airstrike. Half the school was a smoking heap. The bomb had entered through the same hole in the roof made by the first bomb, a perfect hit. More Taliban and Al-Qaeda fighters ran from the jagged reefs of concrete, firing their weapons wildly through the smoke at the surrounding buildings. Tatum worried that they would escape into the city. He radioed the pilots overhead. "Look, we just stood up a hornet's nest. You guys are gonna have to drop another bomb."
"Ready for immediate re-attack," said one. "Requesting clearance."
"Clear." More of the remaining steel and concrete walls blew outward, shattering the trees surrounding the school. Only the front wall facing the street and random portions of remaining walls were still standing. Tatum saw more men stumble from the rubble, faces striped white and red with blood and dust. He was amazed anyone was still walking. Chain-link fence surrounded part of the school, and some of the dazed survivors jumped over it and ran into the neighborhood, darting between houses. Tatum watched as the locals and Afghan soldiers chased them. Most ruthless among them were the Shia Hazaras. The Taliban had slaughtered them by the thousands when they seized the city in August 1998. Now it was the Hazaras' turn. They beat the fighters with shovels and rocks. Back at the school, about 30 Taliban and Al-Qaeda fighters had survived the strikes. They retreated into the rubble and hid in a corner of the building that hadn't collapsed. They would stay there for the next 2 days, exchanging gunfire with Atta's men, before finally surrendering. Hungry, exhausted, somehow at the last choosing life instead of death. Dean was pacing the safe house, waiting for Atta's return. The warlord was traveling somewhere in the city, meeting with tribal elders and rekindling relationships that had been cut short 3 years earlier, when the Taliban captured the town. Dean felt terrible about Atta's men killed at the schoolhouse, but he also felt he had lost face with Atta. And if this was true, the mission could fail. Even though he hadn't bombed the schoolhouse, he was linked to it as an American soldier. Back at the school, Atta's men were dragging the dead men out of the rubble and loading them into a truck. Soon the truck showed up at the safe house. Dean watched as some of the bodies were placed in simple wood caskets. Others were laid in the dirt under the trees. One of Atta's men bent low over the bodies with pliers and heavy wire and bound the feet and hands together so the men would harden in rigor mortis positions that would fit in a coffin. Dean's heart sank at the sight of the dead boys, 15, 16 years old. He had traveled with some of these fighters. He knew them. He resolved to make this right somehow with Atta. The pensive, graying warlord appeared at the safe house later in the day, looking weary. Dean could tell he'd already heard the news. Dean couldn't tell if he was upset. He approached Atta and apologized profusely for the deaths of his soldiers. Atta stood listening and stroking his beard. Dean walked over and shook hands with the commanders of the dead men and gave them a hug. He kept saying how personally sorry he was about the deaths, trying to communicate his contrition with every ounce of body language. Atta asked to talk to Dean privately. They stepped away from the other men. Atta looked him in the eye. He could see Dean was upset. "These things happen in war," he said. "These 9 people will not change the outcome of the war. It is very sad, but we understand." Dean stared at him in disbelief, realizing what might have seemed cold-heartedness on Atta's part was instead wisdom. After that, Dean felt a little better. That night, some Mazar locals brought to Dean's door 2 Pakistani soldiers who'd been wounded in the aftermath of the school bombing. Somehow, after running from the rubble through the city streets, they had escaped death at the hands of Mazar's angry citizens. Now, they were Atta's prisoners. Dean looked at their hands, loosely bound with turbans. He wondered why anyone had even bothered to tie them up. The prisoners glared at Dean and told him they had come to Afghanistan to wage jihad against Americans. Dean thought, "Roger that, and you'd kill me if you had the chance." Medic Jerry Booker went to work, cleaning the prisoners' wounds. The first one was in his late teens, short and skinny. He had a pageboy haircut, thick and heavy. The kid reminded Booker of the movie actor Johnny Depp. Booker asked him questions about the whereabouts of Al-Qaeda operatives in the city. The kid said nothing. Like Dean, Booker saw hate in the kid's eyes. He tapped his chest and heard a dull thud. He realized the boy's pleural cavity was filling with blood and air, and that this was putting pressure on the lung. He laid him down on an old wool blanket on the floor and picked up a pair of forceps from the duffel at his feet. The kid grew wide-eyed, as if he thought Booker was going to hurt him. One of Atta's junior commanders waved Booker away. "Don't treat this piece of human crap." But a senior commander told Booker to operate. The bullet had entered the left shoulder and exited out the chest, also on the left side. The kid was panting, and he looked pale. Every breath magnified the pressure on his collapsing lung, a true sucking chest wound. Booker had never treated one, but he knew what to do. In Special Forces medic training, he'd been told that in a pinch, he could use an endotracheal tube, normally meant for insertion down the throat during surgery, to allow a patient to breathe. But first he had to drain the chest cavity of some of the air and blood. He numbed the left ribs with lidocaine, made an incision between them, inserted the forceps, and spread the bones. He then inserted a catheter into the chest. Booker could hear the trapped air rushing out of the tube with a small whistling noise, followed by blood flowing out onto the floor. Atta's men were holding down the kid, who was screaming in Urdu. Wasik, Dean's translator, told the Americans what he was saying. "They are trying to kill me." He yelled out that he wanted Allah to strike the Americans down. And even though the rib area was numbed, Booker knew the incision had to hurt like hell. To fully drain the blood, he had to insert a larger tube in the kid's back. Again, he numbed the skin before shoving the forceps through the muscle. After the air and blood drained, he capped the hole in his chest with an Asherman chest seal, a dressing that works similarly to the seal on a bag of coffee. The seal lets out air, but it doesn't let any back in. Little by little, the kid's face relaxed as his breathing grew easier. He had finally realized the Americans weren't going to kill him. Booker turned to the other prisoner, an older, bald man in a flowing blue smock and sandals. Blood was running down his face. His scalp was split, probably by the butt of an AK rifle. He was even more defiant than Johnny Depp had been, looking as if he would spit on Booker. The man's eyes darted about nervously as Booker studied his wound. Without provocation, the man erupted in a flurry of epithets. He shouted that he had also come to Afghanistan to kill Americans. Booker, ignoring the outburst, debrided the scalp wound and carefully sewed it up. Afterward, he stepped back and looked the guy square in the eye. "By the way, dude," he said, "I'm an American." When this was translated, the man studied Booker and grunted thanks. Then he was led away. Booker had no idea what would happen to him. Atta's men told him that the younger prisoner would be taken to a hospital. When one of the senior Afghans in the room winked at Booker about this news, Booker thought, "Crap. Why did we even fix these guys if they're going to take them out and slaughter them?" A few days later, though, while touring a hospital, Booker spotted Johnny Depp, shaved and handcuffed to his bed. Booker was thankful he was healthy and alive. The day after the bombing at the school, Dean and Nelson turned their attention to building peace in a shattered city. Still annoyed by Najib Qureshi's persistent questioning, Dean ordered the team to move out of the Qureshi household and into another safe house. It was a propitious move. The new place was practically a palace by Mazar standards, with running hot water, working showers, and flush toilets. Dean set up guards on the roof and a secure perimeter. The team next started conducting what they called bug hunts in the city. These involved driving through the city and visiting with locals, asking them if they were aware of enemy activity in their neighborhood. Each night when Dean climbed up to the roof of the safe house, he heard less and less gunfire. He wondered when they might be able to return to Fort Campbell. The question was increasingly on the minds of all the men. As peace broke out, news reporters started rolling into the city. Alex Perry, who'd been hired by Time as a travel editor, had been trying to enter Afghanistan from Uzbekistan for nearly a month following the attacks in America. Perry had guessed early that the U.S. military would respond by invading Afghanistan, and he had waited out his chance to enter the country in a $25 a night guest house. Perry had worked his satellite phone, calling Dostum, Atta, Mohakik, and their sub-commanders as they rode north on their horses with Nelson, Dean, and Mitchell. Perry filed his stories from an internet cafe in Tashkent, increasingly eager to see the war firsthand. "Are the Taliban leaving Mazar-e-Sharif?" ran the headline of a dispatch he published on November 7, 2001, 2 days after Essex, Milo, and Winehouse were overrun in their trench. No one in the press exactly knew the answer to the question. Reporters had been absent from the battlefield. The teams were operating in near total secrecy. The following day, November 8, Perry filed another story that described his plight as covering a war that nobody wants journalists to get to. Not the Taliban, not the Americans, not the Uzbek border guards, and not, one suspects, the Northern Alliance propaganda chiefs. Hour after hour, Perry would reach wrong numbers and facile explanations while placing calls to contacts in Afghanistan, such as, "Sorry, Commander X is in a battle right now. Can you call back later?" The odd thing was that the person on the other end was sometimes telling the truth. Commander X really was in the field, fighting. Satellite phones and email had multiplied and accelerated the lines of communications. As Nelson, Dean, and Mitchell used horses to ride up the Daryabok River Valley, theirs was the first war to be fought in an age of cheap, ubiquitous, and instant communication. This irony had not been lost on Nelson when he watched Dostum power his portable Theraya satellite phone with a car battery he carried in a saddlebag. Perry was frustrated by the ability to make easy contact while simultaneously being unable to make sense of the situation. Reporting at night from Tashkent was especially hard, because his Afghan interviewees, often low-level commanders and Northern Alliance soldiers, were bombed out of their minds on hash and opium, the drug of choice among the Afghan lower class. The upper class drank vodka, lots of it. His phone interviews often threatened to squib off into drunken blather and stoned silences. He had spent hours trying to arrange safe passage into Mazar-e-Sharif, when finally, a Tashkent press chief invited several hundred journalists to the Uzbekistan border town of Termez on the Amudarya River. Across the half-mile-wide current lay Hiratan in Afghanistan. The press chief was desperately buttering up reporters to write about Uzbekistan's fabulous generosity in opening its border to deliver humanitarian aid to Afghanistan. He put a dozen reporters on the first barge of food aid, with strict instructions to return with the ship. When they arrived in Hiraton, Perry watched his fellow journalists dutifully filming the unloading of food from the barge. Perry himself quietly slipped out of the port and caught a taxi that took him straight to General Atta's safe house in Mazar, 30 miles south. Perry, although a seasoned reporter, had never worked in a combat zone. Yet he was surprised to find that he had become one of the first journalists to enter Mazar-i-Sharif after its fall. He felt he was on to something big. As he sat at dinner with Atta, rice, raisins, onions, carrots, and boiled mutton, he met an enterprising and eager young man who spoke excellent English and harbored dreams of becoming a correspondent for CNN. Or so he had told the last guests in his house, gruff American soldiers who moved out abruptly. Perry hired the young man on the spot as his translator and fixer, or guide. The young man introduced himself as Najib Qureshi. The day after his arrival, Perry visited the Sultan Reza School. 5 days after the bombing, Red Cross workers were still engaged in the grim chore of collecting the approximately 400 bodies of Al-Qaeda and Taliban soldiers. Perry wrote, "The stench of death hung across the ruins. The team concentrated on intact bodies that could be lifted by the arms and legs. Elsewhere, fire had reduced everything, furniture, clothing, people, to ash." When Dean learned that reporters were in Mazar-i-Sharif, he took immediate, if simple, measures to avoid detection. Men and women toting laptops and cameras were pouring into the city, on the hunt for a story about the lightning-quick victory of a group of mysterious American soldiers on horseback, armed with lasers. Because the soldiers had left the state secretly, and because no reporters had been embedded with them, a concept that wouldn't come to the fore within Pentagon public relations for another 2 years, there had been a virtual news blackout. Nothing concrete was known about Nelson, Dean, and Mitchell. Certainly neither their names nor their faces had been published in any kind of public media. But the reporters were still largely stymied in getting a story. They spent their days hanging out in Mazar's only working hotel, talking mainly to each other about what might be happening in the street. It's difficult to imagine now, but in 2001, few reporters had any connection with locals on the ground. No ready-made network of contacts and translators. The same kind of supply lines the soldiers relied on to stay alive. For Dean, whose modus operandi depended on his ability to blend in with local citizens and operate behind the scenes, the media was a new kind of digital age meta-enemy. Within minutes, his face could be broadcast around the world, accessible to anyone with a television or an internet connection. The thought horrified him. At the least, this disclosure could give the larger jihadi world the impression that the Americans had invaded and captured Afghanistan, creating ill will toward the entire post-war rebuilding of the country. At the worst, publishing his name, face, and location could get him killed. There was still a bounty on all of the soldiers. $100,000 for the body of each dead American soldier, to be paid by bin Laden's Al-Qaeda network. Another scenario haunted the men. They feared some wannabe Al-Qaeda nutjob might show up outside their homes in the States. The possibility was too chilling to consider. In short, having a reporter take your picture was like posing for your own wanted poster. On bug hunts, the teams moved quickly and decisively through the city, keeping watch for anyone pointing a camera at them. If they were spotted, they left that area. They hid behind wraparound sunglasses, scarves, and pakul hats, to avoid being recognizable in any pictures. Several days after they'd moved into the new safe house, Communication Sergeant Brian Lyle and Weapons Sergeant Mark House were spotted in the bustling market area by a group of what looked like photographers. Dean was at the safe house pulling security duty when his radio crackled to life. Lyle reported that the men were toting serious-looking cameras. Lyle and House had jumped in their truck and peeled away, but they couldn't shake their pursuers. Dean could hear the panic in their voices. The photographers were swerving over the road, barely missing kids playing in the streets. Lyle told Dean they were afraid somebody was going to get run over. "Drive by the safe house," said Dean. "Don't look at it. Just drive, and we'll see how many there are." He saw their pickup race past, followed by a yellow sedan driven by three men pointing cameras out the windows. Dean got back on the radio. "All right. Lead them to an isolated area and box them in somehow. Stop the car, get out, and then bum rush them. Tell them to stop photographing you, and that if they continue, tell them you're going to destroy their car. And lastly, explain to them the whole Massoud incident," Dean added, recalling how the Northern Alliance leader Ahmed Shah Massoud had been assassinated 2 months earlier by Al-Qaeda operatives posing as photographers. Lyle and House turned down an alley, came to the end, wheeled around, and started driving back out. They let the photographer's car pass and complete the same maneuver. And when it was behind them, Lyle wrenched the wheel and turned the truck across the road, blocking the path. He and House stepped out and ran at the photographer's car. The men inside looked as if they might piss their pants. "Don't take our picture," Lyle said calmly. "It'll endanger us, and it endangers our families." The photographers sputtered and cursed in French. "Fuck you! What about freedom of the press?" But Lyle remained calm and repeated again what he had said. He saw that they were buying it. He knew that if he stayed calm and friendly, they would have little to react to. The photographers talked over the request and told Lyle they wouldn't take his picture, at least for now. "Thank you," said Lyle. He and House sped away, as anonymous as when they had left. As Dean's and Nelson's teams ran bug hunts in the city, Mark Mitchell oversaw post-war operations from a second-story office in Kala Ijangi. The office was part of Dostum's spacious headquarters, which opened onto a long balcony overlooking the rose garden, placid groves of trees, and the cold, narrow stream flowing through the northern courtyard. Across the courtyard, about 150 yards from the balcony, stood the 60-foot-high mud wall that separated the fort in two. In the southern courtyard, on the other side of the tall wall, several mysterious buildings sat among the stones and thorns, relics of the Soviets' occupation of the fort when they'd used it, like Dostum and the Taliban later, as a headquarters. One of the buildings was painted a startling pink, the flesh of the faintest rose, in stark contrast to the beige and gray of the fort's dry mud walls. None of the Americans knew exactly what the pink building had been used for. Dean and Nelson believed it must have been a school, because the floor measured about as much as a one-room schoolhouse in the States, about 75 feet on each side. But it was the basement that gave one the willies. You entered by means of stairs, standing about 50 feet off the side of the building itself. The doorway was made of stacked brick, with mud steps leading down 75 feet into darkness. The basement might have been a storeroom for ammunition, as the walls and ceiling were several feet thick and reinforced with metal bars. Not one of the Americans, or even the Afghans, knew for sure. All stories seemed apocryphal, especially the one that the basement, which was dark and silent as a grave, had been a dungeon The Americans had simply started calling the building the Pink House. The rear wall of Mitchell's office, in the northern end of the fort, had been painted as a mural of an undersea fantasy land, with green fans of coral and exotically colored fish. Mitchell surmised that the Taliban hadn't destroyed the painting, because it did not depict the faces of people or animals. Fish, he guessed, were A-OK with the Taliban. Soon after moving into the fort, nearly everyone on the teams grew deathly ill. When fresh water had failed to arrive on a resupply drop, they'd taken their chances drinking from the local tap, and now everyone regretted the decision. Ben Milo was struck with a case of diarrhea that he felt would kill him. It would last 9 days. He and the rest of his team were camped in 3 miserable rooms in the northern end of the fort, on the second floor. At one point, Milo grew so sick that he had to sleep in the bathroom, hurriedly scuttling between his sleeping bag and the dark hole in the floor a few feet away. The very air in the fort seemed diseased. The men explored its maze of dank rooms and dark passageways, the halogen beams of their flashlights passing over rough mud walls that sprouted tufts of animal hair and straw, crude building materials, and revealed odd sights. Some rooms were filled floor to ceiling with small sticks. Others were piled high with shoes. Some seemed to have been the scene of horrific struggles, the floors tracked with heavy boots and dried pools of blood. After a half hour of wandering, the men would step out of a doorway and into another part of the fort, without any idea of how they'd arrived there. The Magic Castle, some of them called it. As part of post-war operations, Mitchell was busy preparing to dispose of the immense weapons and ammunition cache that the Taliban had left behind. 6 Connex trailers hulked in the weeds in the southern compound. The rear doors of the trailers swung open with a screech. Inside lay hundreds of rifles, rockets, ammo, grenades, mortars, and BM-21 rockets. Enough materiel to outfit an army. These were the Taliban's spoils of war, after 3 years of occupying Mazar. Mitchell marveled over the World War I rifles of French extraction, the Russian long guns, and the World War II-era machine guns. He picked up a British Enfield and admired the glint of its bayonet in the stormy half-light of the metal trailer. A bayonet. It was stamped with a date, 1913. On the day he was to cart the weapons away to a distant stretch of desert where they would be blown up, the ammunition cache started exploding on its own. The racket was incredible. At first, Mitchell wondered if they were under attack. He ran from his office to see what was the matter. Mitchell would never discover the cause of this spontaneous explosion. It took about a minute to run from the north balcony to the southern courtyard. Passing through the tall gate in the middle dividing wall, he heard the small arms ammunition, crack, 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 and then the mortars, shwoom, followed by BM-21 rockets. The rockets banged around inside the metal trailers and sailed out the open doors, smashing into the interior walls of the fort, or sailing cleanly over and exploding outside in a surrounding field. Mitchell retreated immediately. The fireworks lasted several hours. When he reconned the trailers, he saw that most of them had blown up and been incinerated. The insides were a cooked mess, consisting of twisted gun barrels and charred hunks of steel. Several trailers were more or less intact. Mitchell wanted to take care of these, too, and he made a note in his green hardback notebook to have this done as soon as possible. If by some fluke the fort was attacked and fell into the hands of the Taliban, well, Mitchell didn't even want to imagine that. 2 days after they arrived in the city, The Americans received good news that the battle in other parts of the country was also going well. Northern Alliance soldiers had captured Herat, 60 miles west of Mazar, and Kabul, 150 miles to the south. Soon other villages, Taskurgan, Hiratan, Puli Kumri, Talokan, Bamiyan, fell too. From Kabul, the Taliban had headed south to Kandahar, their spiritual base. In the north, they retreated to Kunduz, 60 miles east of Mazar. The Taliban government was collapsing. In Kabul, young men like Rocky Bahari, an amateur boxer and schoolteacher, were ecstatic to see the Taliban leave the city. After the Taliban took charge of Kabul, at the height of the civil war in 1997, there had been fewer robberies by highway bandits, fewer explosions in the middle of the night. But Rocky had discovered that the security the Taliban had brought to the country came with a heavy price. One's very freedom. Rocky did not understand why the Taliban made religion seem like a jail. They didn't let women go to school or work. If a woman's husband died, she had to beg on the street. "For the sake of God, give me money." Often she and her children would starve. In defiance to their rule, Rocky had refused to grow a beard. One day he was arrested on his way to the university, where he was scheduled to take an exam. Rocky ended up spending a week in jail because he was clean-shaven. It had almost seemed humorous. The Taliban executed women in the soccer stadium for sleeping with men who weren't their husbands. They cut off the hands of robbers. White-coated doctors would anesthetize them on the warm grass on the soccer pitch and do the operation in front of thousands of cheering people. This was disgusting, beyond human comprehension. He believed that the future had to be brighter than the darkest past. Rocky had lost his father, sister, and brother during the fighting with the Soviet troops. They had been riding in a taxi when it crashed with a Russian army truck. Rocky had to go to work selling milk to support his family after that. With the Soviets gone and Afghans fighting each other, there had been little work in the city for any man, except to join the Taliban and fight the Northern Alliance. Rocky sat in his small food shop all day, waiting for life to change. One day, he was walking down a street in Kabul when he saw a jet from one of the warring factions' air force streak overhead. Rocky saw the jet drop a bomb on a nearby house, and he watched the house's roof fly off and go twirling across the street and crash. He heard a rubbery sound, plop, and looked down at the ground. At his feet was a woman's hand. It had fallen out of the sky. It was lying with the fingers extended in the dirt, palm down, as if gripping the earth. What Rocky noticed were the woman's fingernails. They were painted red with nail polish. She was wearing a ring. She was somebody's wife, he told himself. She had been somebody's mother. Back at Kala Ijangi, Mark Mitchell heard stories about Taliban soldiers who'd punish children by cutting off their arms and legs to avenge their parents' attempted escape from the city of Talokan, 25 miles from Kunduz. The stories horrified him and made him think that any battle in those cities would be enormously challenging. In fact, as the Taliban's control of the rest of the country collapsed, it did appear that Kunduz would be their last stronghold, which they would defend to their deaths. On November 13, the British media reported that Osama bin Laden had a videotaped statement claiming responsibility for the attacks on American soil 9 weeks earlier. "History should be a witness that we are terrorists," he said. "Yes. We kill American innocents." despite Pakistan's diplomatic reassurances that it was America's ally. Al-Qaeda's ties to Afghanistan and Pakistan were increasingly clear. The CIA was picking up intelligence that approximately 35 Al-Qaeda members, based in Pakistan, were planning to blow up the U.S. consulate in Peshawar. Moreover, it appeared that Al-Qaeda planned to use Pakistan's nuclear capability for further attacks. This news reminded Mitchell that the war was far from finished. 4 days after arriving in Mazar, Bowers convened a series of meetings at Kala-i-Jangi with Dostum, Atta, and the Hazara general, Mohammad Mahakik, hoping to lessen tension among the three warlords. He wryly referred to these as the Paris peace talks after the 1972 ceasefire discussions between North and South Vietnam. Bowers realized that he needed to unite these men, bound together by the war, in common cause, or risk a repeat of the tribal warfare that had erupted when the Soviets left. "This is your country, not ours," he began. "We will help you all we can. We have no desire to take anything or to be responsible for your government." By the end of the meetings, the warlords had decided who would run the electric plant, the water system, and humanitarian efforts. The critical miscellany of daily life in a 15th-century town of shopkeepers, doctors, and teachers, struggling in the 21st century. Next, Bowers and the warlords turned their attention to Kunduz, 60 miles away, in the country's eastern corner. Kunduz was a city under siege, a place of hellish spectacle. As intel reports trickled in, indications were that the city of 220,000 was boiling over with Taliban and Al-Qaeda soldiers. The streets seethed with bandits, freelancers of no political stripe taking advantage of the chaotic situation. Soldiers broke into restaurants and stores looking for food. Families were killing their burros and eating them. Refugees were fleeing the city to camps outside of Mazar, or trying to. Men were shot in the back at checkpoints as they ran beyond the city limits. Those who escaped spoke of atrocities committed by the Taliban, of citizens forced to run across minefields to the amusement of Taliban soldiers looking on. To prevent soldiers from abandoning their ranks, Taliban leaders ordered that the suspicious among them stuff their shoes with thorns. Those citizens who managed to make it to refugee camps found conditions that were not much better. Alex Perry, the Time reporter, discovered thousands of people living in stick tents draped with black garbage bag tarps on the outskirts of Mazar. Families of 8 or 9 were forced to share one blanket through the increasingly cold nights. Perry saw that the refugees owned nothing except a few pots and pans. When the American soldiers pulled up in their pickups, men, women, and children swarmed the vehicles, saying, "Thank you, thank you," and making a hand-to-mouth gesture, "I'm hungry." Stu Mansfield, on Dean's team, gave one of his guards a pair of new boots to replace a pair of worn slippers. The guard thanked him profusely, and then gave the boots to a young boy who ran downtown, sold them, and returned with some money, which the man pocketed. Mansfield could only shrug, thinking that he had still done the right thing. In an attempt to make the Taliban and Al-Qaeda soldiers surrender in Kunduz, B-52s trolled overhead, dropping bombs on fleeing trucks and tanks. At night, Spectre AC-130 gunships pounded the hillsides where the enemy forces were camped in trenches. In the dark, the specially outfitted planes flew at high altitudes and remained invisible to the enemy on the ground. The Spectre could shoot thousands of bullets per minute from Gatling guns and could fire artillery shells, barrels poking from the side of the plane. The enemy soldiers on the ground believing they were concealed by darkness, often didn't know where the deadly fire was coming from. On board each gunship, a weapons officer tracked enemy movements on a video screen. Human bodies resembled glowing grains of rice. The engines of trucks appeared as intense hotspots in the plane's heat-sensing optics. The weapons on board were aimed by means of a joystick. The torrent of fire from the plane was relentless and accurate. Dostum had been delighted to discover that one of the Spectre's crew members was a female. He had been listening to his radio when he heard her voice amid the pilot's chatter. Dostum, who was standing alongside Nelson as the night attack unfolded, turned and asked, disbelieving, "Is that a woman?" Even though he professed an egalitarian streak, Dostum had met few women in positions of power in his lifetime. "Ha!" he chortled into the radio, talking to the Taliban soldiers. "The Americans think so little of you that they have sent a woman to kill you." The Taliban shouted into their radios, cursing Dostum and the Americans. "I will call her the Angel of Death," Dostum kidded the Taliban. The Taliban were apoplectic. After several days of daily and nightly bombardment by B-52s and Spectre gunships, all roads in and out of Kunduz were sealed. For the Taliban and Al-Qaeda soldiers trapped there, they had one choice to make: surrender or die. The trapped fighters fell into two camps. The Afghan Taliban, who, if they did surrender, were allowed to join the alliance or else return to their villages and pick up their lives. A man's newly sworn allegiance was his bond. These conscripts weren't even searched when they switched sides. The other camp was comprised of foreign Taliban, soldiers from Chechnya, Pakistan, and China, and their hardcore brethren, Al-Qaeda, with whom the Taliban had allied. Surrenders by these men were rare, and often perfidious. An enemy soldier would walk up to a member of the Northern Alliance and blow himself up with a grenade hidden in his clothes. "We are going to be martyrs," one of the hardcore fighters announced to the press. "We are not going from Kunduz." The Northern Alliance soldiers decided they had no choice but to shoot foreign Taliban soldiers on sight. There were approximately 3,000 of these committed soldiers in Kunduz, and Bowers knew that his team's next move would be to rid this city of would-be martyrs. Meanwhile, a faction of these otherwise suicidal fighters did entertain surrender, if they could keep their weapons and were offered safe passage from the city. When he learned of the proposal, Secretary of Defense Donald Rumsfeld in Washington, D.C., refused to accept it. He warned that if these particular prisoners were allowed to go free, they'd live to fight another day, and that this wasn't a palatable outcome. "My hope," he told the press, "is that they will either be killed or taken prisoner." In preparation for the battle in Kunduz, Bowers and Mitchell's team moved their headquarters out of the squalid conditions of Kala Ijangi to some place more hospitable. Over the previous 10 days, Mitchell, like everyone else, had grown ill in the fort, and he was glad to settle nearer downtown Mazar, into a modern 5-story building known as the Turkish Schoolhouse. The new headquarters offered a commanding view of the city. From the roof, Mitchell could see the Blue Mosque, located less than a mile to the west in the middle of town. Traffic streamed steadily past on the road fronting the school, piercing the air with the screech of brakes and the braying of car horns. The Turkish government had built the boys' high school in the 1970s as a gift to the Afghan government. It had once been a gleaming monument to bureaucratic elegance, with its rows of small tinted windows and decorative concrete facade. The Taliban had ripped the plumbing and electrical fixtures from the walls during their hasty exit 12 days earlier, and now the building was a mess. But in comparison to Qala-i Jangi, the place was clean and well